My name is Hartwell Carson. I'm the French Broad Riverkeeper, and I work for an organization called Mountain True. Riverkeepers are all under the umbrella of the Waterkeeper Alliance. So it's a global network of water keepers around the world. So baykeepers, soundkeepers, riverkeepers. And there's almost 300 keepers now around the world.
So here's my selfish beginning to our conversation. I grew up in Winnemac, Indiana, a little town. We lived right on the river. It was a Tippecanoe River. I had a little John boat when I was a kid. You know, I would dink around out there. But now here I am 20 years later in Asheville. It's the French Broad. We looked at two-person kayaks, and they were, whatever, $900. There's four of us. My wife says, I want us to be together in the boat. So we go out by a used raft.
It's a great family vehicles to get down the river.
So you feel good? Okay. So far, I haven't done a really stupid thing. So as I begin to use the river and I want to be safe and I want to start to care about it and I want to be a part of protecting it, maybe, what kind of stuff should I be thinking about as I get started out on the river?
Well, I mean, other than the obvious, like, water safety stuff, which most people know when they get out on the river, you know, rapids and all that sort of stuff. I mean, really, water quality is a concern, and it's what we deal with most of the time. We do a lot of river recreation stuff, so we do paddle trips, and we take people down the river, and we built and opened the French Broad River Paddle Trail, which is a series of campsites that links about 140 miles of the French Broad River from Rosman all the way up to Douglas Lake. And the river's gotten much, much healthier than it used to be. You know, prior to the Clean Water Act, Wilma Dykeman, the author of the book, The French Broad, she said the French Broad was too thick to drink and too thin to plow. And now, any given Saturday, there are thousands of people out using the river. And people are buying rafts to go float down the river, which really didn't happen a lot until really like 5 or 10 years ago. River recreation kind of exploded in Asheville. And it's been cool. And it's great because the river has gotten clean enough to allow that to happen, but the river's not as clean as we'd like it to be. I mean, we definitely still have places that aren't safe to swim, and we have problems that happen with rain events. E. coli levels will spike. There's way too much sediment in the river, which a lot of people don't realize is actually our biggest pollution source. So sediment washes off construction sites, it washes off agricultural fields and stream bank erosion, and it basically chokes aquatic life to death. And more harmful stuff attached to the sediment, stuff like E. coli will attach to the sediment and get washed to the river. So those are stuff to think about. Basically, my rule of thumb is, if the river's super muddy, I don't go swimming in it. If it's clear, it's great. It'll be clean and nice. And we find, like most of our sites, we monitor bacteria throughout the watershed and post those to a website called the Swim Guide. And most of our sites are clean, you know, 70 to 80% of the time. So that's a pretty good success story, I would say. But we'd certainly love them to be clean 100% of the time.
So I told you that I was thinking about a film project related to the river. What are some things you would like to see in it? What are some issues that you think would be important? If it was a chance to where a couple hundred people would see this or more, what would you hope would be in there?
That's a good question. I mean, I think following the history of the river is pretty interesting. You know, from historical perspective, you know, the DeSoto, you know, traveled the French Broad, that kind of stuff's interesting. But I think even more interesting is sort of the history of the health of the river. You know, how bad it used to be. I mean, there were tanneries and factories dumping raw waste and sewage into the river. The river was said to be totally dead of anything living in it for 20 miles downstream of like the Acosta paper mill that was in Brevard during the time period. And then sort of following the revitalization is pretty interesting. The river, the passage of the Clean Water Act and different groups, you know, coming together and the state coming together to clean up the river and, you know, sort of how we've gotten to today. I mean, there are multiple river outfitters. You know, there'll be Saturdays where you feel like you could walk across the French Broad River standing on inner tubes, you know, and that's kind of a, you know, neat recent phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. I'm about 3/4 of the way through the Dykeman.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What other documents would you point to that would talk about some of those historical elements that you were just referring to? Or is that just...
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. I have... I have some of that stuff. There's an old report from like 1955 that the state did that documents pollution in the French Broad. And it talks about the river being dead for 20 miles downstream of the paper mill. And basically the only factory or municipality that treated their waste at all was Brevard. And that was just for smell because it smelled so bad.
Who else should I talk to?
You know, Bill Aker was, I mean, if you think of like, I guess it depends on what you're going for. If you want like the old history, like he's been around a long time. I think he still worked for Landis-Skye he did a lot of water stuff throughout the years. I mean, he would kind of give you that lens of 20, 30 years ago. Also, Dave Donnell at Asheville Outdoor Center, he's operated the Asheville Outdoor Center for 25 years. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of interesting. I mean, he was around way before the French Broad was cool. And they're celebrating their 25th anniversary this year.
I've met Dave. I didn't realize they were celebrating that anniversary.
Yeah.
How about the, so one reason I know I came across your name was the Riverkeeper's Guide to the French Broad. You know, I have that.
Cool.
Can you tell me how that came about? And can you tell me about working with Chris Gibbs?
Yeah, sure. So a friend of mine and I paddled the French Broad all the way from Roseman to Knoxville maybe 10 years ago. And it was kind of a work trip. It was kind of, I was new and didn't know the river well. So we were like, let's go see what's out there. We did some events along the way and the trip garnered a lot of media attention. People were really interested in it. And a lot of people later came up to us and said, that sounds great. Like, I want to go do that trip too. And unfortunately, I had to tell them, you can't really do it. There's nowhere to publicly camp. There's no, you know, the access is not great. So we kind of set out to build the paddle trail, which would allow people to do that. You know, take a night or 10 nights and paddle all the way to Douglas Lake. And once we did that, we realized we needed to tell people how to do it. So we created an app. We have a website. And then we have the waterproof paper guide to the French Broad River. And Chris was just a friend of mine. He had made a lot of maps, fishing maps, big fisherman, and we kind of collaborated. He made it look pretty. I gave him a lot of the information, and then it worked out good.
So if I were gonna try that, and I were gonna do that with my wife and kids, ages 10 and 8, good idea, bad idea? What do I need to know first?
Well, I think it'd be great. I've totally done it with 3 kids, 2 adults, and a raft. I think it's a great trip. The French Broad's pretty cool in that it's totally flat water for part of the river. And then you get into some mild, very mild white water, and then there's some bigger white water. So you can kind of get whatever you want. The beginning of the river, it looks much different than the, you know, once you get into like the hot springs area. So you can get like 2 totally different kind of river experiences. Yeah, I think it's a great trip. Kind of depends on what you want to go for, like how long, how many days, what kind of scenery, what,
you know,
kind of
wild. Part of me thinks that it works as a through story for the film I'm thinking about doing, meaning as you move through the river, you can cut to history, you can cut to somebody like Dave when you pass his spot on the river, you offer little glimpses of the campground, and we cut to you, you know, talking about problem spots. So as you sort of are looking around for a through story, that's one through story.
Yeah.
I have to convince my wife if that's going to be the through.
Oh, that'd be great. You could do it in sections, too. You know, you could do 2 nights at a time.
Yep.
Get the next. So we're actually doing this summer for the first time. We used to do a 9-day trip, take people from the beginning of the river all the way to Tennessee. And then this year, we're section paddling the whole river. So 2nd and 4th Saturday of every month, my coworkers taking groups of folks, and we paddle section, and then the next week we pick up where we left off. So you can paddle the whole river without ever spending a night out there. But
is that different from the stuff you were doing with the breweries who made the special beer? And then tell us about that.
So yeah, this year, I mean, there's nothing Asheville and the community around here likes more than beer and the river. So we decided to partner with 5 different breweries to make a unique beer for us and promote one each month. And we also partner with a series of outfitters. And so we partner with an outfitter and a brewery every month. We did the section paddles, which is part of what we're doing throughout the month. And we did a river cleanup. So we do a river cleanup, and then we've gone to the brewery and had like a beer release party. So it's been kind of cool. we've had some good beer. We've also gotten to make beer early in the morning and drink beer Mondays at 9:30 a.m., which is right. Cool. And yeah, it's just
so you think to yourself, I'm at work. I'm on the river. It's 9:45. I'm having a beer. Here I am working. Yeah, nice.
When you're at a brewery and a brewer offers you a beer, it's rude not to accept, I think.
So, I agree.
Regardless of the time of day.
So you may know quite a bit about these things. You may not. A couple seems like kind of big stories to me about the river. Is there a possibility there still be a whitewater park? Are you excited about that? Are you worried about that?
I think it'd be awesome. The latest I heard is it still could happen. They're looking at a couple different locations. I think it'd be great. I mean, even though the river has gotten popular, I still think the more people that use the river will care about the river, and they're not going to want to see pollution. They're not going to want to see sediment. I mean, you know, the fact that we had a story recently about high E. coli levels, and people were really interested in that. I feel like 10, 15 years ago, nobody would have cared because nobody used the river. You know, now everybody's out there tubing, and so that really creates... And I just think it'd be great for the community. Like, they've been wildly successful in other places, springing up greenways and river recreation and outfitters. And I think it'd be good. I think it'd be really cool.
Does anybody ask you what you think about stuff like that? Do you have strong opinions?
As far as the Whitewater Park?
Sure.
Yeah, I think the Whitewater Park would be great. And I've definitely advocated for it. I went to the city council meeting and wore my life jacket with a bunch of other paddler folks to say it was a good idea. And I'm still sort of talking to the folks that are really pushing that to try and do what I can to make that happen.
Go ahead.
I was in Boise last summer, and they have done the same thing there. And so I got to see it firsthand and thought it was really, really cool to see, you know, the trails and people out using the river and kind of see what it could be, which was pretty neat.
So if you build a park like that, and you may not know, do I have to pay to use the park? And if I'm just floating through the river, can I get around it? How does that work?
Yeah, I think that's sort of the big thing. I don't know about like the fee structure or whatever, but I don't think there was any fee in Boise, and I don't think there would be here. And yeah, part of the design would be to create an easy way to get around for tubers and then create a more challenging way for folks that want to play in the wave and surf and...
So I think you might have done a little bit of writing about the concentrated animal feeding operation. Maybe that was on Hominy Creek. What's been going on with that? Or maybe say a little bit about it.
Sure.
Summarize your story and then tell us where we're at on that.
Yeah, so we're part of Waterkeeper Alliance campaign with all the North Carolina river keepers to look at really factory farming. It got started in eastern North Carolina because there are these massive, you know, 50,000 head of pig that... reside in these, you know, feeding lots that create massive amounts of waste. I mean, these are small cities of waste. And unlike a small city that has to have a wastewater treatment plant, they put all the waste in a lagoon and then they spray it on their fields. In theory, that doesn't run off into the river and it doesn't create groundwater contamination. In reality, it grossly pollutes waterways around the state. And we have a very small piece of that here. We don't have the big giant factory farms, but we do have some animal operations that have caused a lot of water quality problems. We have the swim guide, which I mentioned before. One of our sites is on Hominy Creek, so we monitor that site on a regular basis. And unfortunately, we found that was our worst site. It was dirty probably 50% of the time. So we went looking for why that was the case, and looked all up and down the watershed and found what is called a concentrated animal feeding operation, permitted by the state. They are not supposed to discharge their waste into the waterways, but we found a pipe that basically was plumbed from their giant waste lagoon, which is just full of animal waste, straight into Hominy Creek. So the state followed up on that, did a great job of making sure that was stopped and wouldn't happen again. And we hope to see the data improving. It hasn't improved a lot, but we are hoping it will improve. And once the kind of closing out of that operation happens, and hoping Hominy Creek will get cleaner.
So that operation is closing in part or totally because of your report, or not quite?
I don't know if they're closing, but they're having a cleanup. So they're cleaning up the way they discharge their waste. They're supposed to, you know, spray it on the fields and keep that from running off into the river. And what they did is they put a pipe into the bottom of the lagoon and piped it straight to the waterways.
What's this exact location, or do you not really want to say?
No, it's right off Pond Road. So it's like, it's above the Greenway segment, which is very popular. People frequently, you know, go down there and swim, dogs play in it. And unfortunately, the E. coli levels are pretty high there. So we're going to do some more work because I don't think that's the only source on Hamidi Creek. I'm hoping it's a big source, because if it is, the levels will start to drop and hopefully it can finally meet the goals of the Clean Water Act.
Do you talk with some of the people at the farm, or you don't meet, you just take the water
sample?
Sometimes
we do.
And
yeah,
do people get angry when they see you coming? Do they get worried? Is it confrontational? How does that go?
Yeah, sometimes. If it's sort of a gross violation, usually we'll just turn it into the state. I mean, that was, you know, very illegal to illegally pipe your waste in the river. So that was an issue we turned over to the state. Now, if we have a farm where, say, the cattle are getting in the creek and they're causing water quality problems, we're definitely, you know, not anti-farm, and we're happy to work with any farmers that want to work with us to make improvements. So, you know, to try and get fencing in, to try and coordinate them with the county and maybe get them some funding to improve, you know, improve water quality through those measures. So it really kind of depends. Like, we use all the tools in the toolbox. Like, we're friendly and work with people at every chance possible. But sometimes you have an adversary like a Duke Energy that doesn't respond to friendly. And so in that case, we've sued Duke Energy, and that litigation resulted in the cleanup of the Asheville coal ash pond. So sometimes you have to use all the tools that you got to.
So when you say we sue Duke Energy, first let's back up. Can you say just, you know, sure, quick overview of what Duke Energy did?
Yeah.
And then who's the we that sues them?
Yeah, so Duke Energy is the largest utility in the United States. And for hundreds of years, they dug holes in the ground and put all their waste in there. And that waste is from burning coal. That leaves coal ash behind, which has a slew of toxic heavy metals, arsenic and chromium, and, you know, really nasty stuff that you don't want in your groundwater and you don't want in your waterways. It doesn't take a genius to figure out an unlined hole in the ground is going to cause problems. It's going to leach into the groundwater. It springs, you know, they're all held back by these earthen dams, which spring leaks. Those go straight into the river, and there's always the potential for a catastrophic failure. So, years ago, probably 7 years ago, we started to raise the alarm that this was an issue. We went out and monitored the French Broad here and found illegal discharges from the coal ash ponds. There was ample groundwater contamination. We pushed Duke Energy to do something about that, and we pushed the state to do something about that, but no one would respond. So we partnered with the Southern Environmental Law Center, which is a great partner in a lot of the work that we do. And, you know, they have the power of the law behind them. The Clean Water Act says it's illegal to discharge pollutants to waterways without a permit. And Duke was clearly doing that. And those lawsuits were able to push the cleanup of really probably about half the coal ash ponds in the state are now either being cleaned up or scheduled to be cleaned up. But we're pushing hard for those other half too, because Duke is fighting back for sure.
And there was some recent news, maybe it was House Bill 630. Did something change? Did they get off the hook a little bit on something? Is that not clear?
Yeah, so because of the Dan River spill, which was the massive spill in the Dan River where their pipe busted and released, you know, hundreds of thousands of gallons of coal ash into the Dan River, the Coal Ash Management Act was passed by the North Carolina General Assembly. That act specified certain sites would be cleaned up. The sites that we had sued over were scheduled to be cleaned up. And, sorry, my phone.
That's okay.
So Dan River spill, passed the Coal Ash Management Act. Some sites were written into the act as high priority sites, like Asheville, because we were suing over them. And other sites said we would study them and determine if they're low, intermediate, or high hazard sites. Intermediate and high hazard would be cleaned up. Low priority sites, they basically throw a tarp over it and call it good, which in our opinion is not sufficient because this stuff is still sitting in the groundwater. They would dry it out, so that is a good step, but still not sufficient. And they studied it and they determined we were right, that these were polluting groundwater and they should be cleaned up. So the state actually ranked all of the sites intermediate, which means they had to be cleaned up, but they had to be done on a slower time frame than the high hazard sites. And unfortunately, you know, Duke Energy didn't like the answer. So they went to the state, and they have a lot of power in the state legislature, and they, you know, cowtailed to their wishes and passed a law that basically overrode the law that they had already passed, making them clean it up. So it basically says they have to provide drinking water to people, which is a good step, but then they all get ranked as low priority. So they provide drinking water to people, but they don't ever clean it up. So it continues to pollute our groundwater and our rivers. They just help folks by making sure they're not drinking it. But they doesn't ever get, the environment never gets cleaned up.
How do they get drinking water to the people?
They're probably going to run water lines, so that is an important step, but Duke was going to have to do that anyway. You can't poison people's well and not provide them clean water. So the recent bill really was a giant step backwards. We'd won a huge victory that they all were going to be cleaned up, and you know, Duke went and threw some money around the legislators and changed the law.
So the Asheville site, is that Lake Julian? Is that somewhere else?
Yeah, so it's the power plant right there at Lake Julian. So the coal ash ponds are on the other side. Those are being cleaned up, and a lot of that ash is being moved to the airport in a lined landfill. They're also moving some to Cliffside, and they're moving some to a landfill in Georgia. So those will all be dug up and cleaned up, and therefore eliminating the potential for that ash to... the dam to burst, it eliminates the groundwater pollution over time, and it eliminates the illegal discharges. And there are people that are drinking contaminated water around the Asheville power plant. So those people need clean drinking water, but we also need to clean up the groundwater to make sure we don't pollute future wells.
That's a long story. There's a lot to all that, isn't there?
Oh yeah, that's like hours and hours.
Wow.
Suing and the state pretending to do something and not actually doing anything. The first time we sued, the state responded with a $100,000 fine for several facilities and basically said they could study it forever. And that was, and there was a giant public outcry. I don't think the state anticipated that people would actually care as much as they did.
And there are people right now who are drinking, they're drinking well water and it's contaminated because of the Duke plants.
Yeah.
They still live there. They still
live there. Duke has been providing bottled water to those people. Mm-hmm. But some of those were overlooked. I mean, we just found a well at Cliffside. Actually, a news team sampled this gentleman's well and found high levels of hexavalent chromium. And Duke had missed sampling as well. So they're now providing him, you know, bottled water. But, you know, these people can't take showers. They have to cook with bottled water.
How large a swath of land are we talking?
It depends. Each power plant's a little bit different. Some it's just a handful of wells. Some it's, dozens, if not hundreds of wells.
How many plants do you think?
There's 14 plants across the state. Each plant, most of those have multiple coal ash pits, too. So Asheville has two. Some have more than that. So it's a big problem, and I get why Duke doesn't want to deal with it, because it's expensive, but... you can't pollute our rivers and pollute people's drinking water wells and not have to face the consequences.
So I've exchanged just a couple of short emails with State Representative Brian Turner. Do you know him? Is he a friend? Does he have a lot of things to balance? What would you have to say about him?
I know him a little bit. I haven't, unfortunately, the pro-environmental folks like Brian Turner are not in power. Mm. And so there's not a lot of good stuff happening. And so I think given the opportunity, I think he would, you know, he would happily push some good things along. He's helped, you know, he's voted against some bad bills, but they're just not enough of him to defeat those.
So is it as simple as a Democratic vote is a vote for the river, or not quite that simple?
Well, unfortunately, the environment has become very partisan, and it's really unfortunate because clean air and clean water should not be a partisan issue, but it has become that, and...
we think there are people from both parties on the river.
Yeah, there's absolutely. I mean, if right. Whoever you talk to that's elected official, they'll tell you they love the river and they love the water, and they want to protect our waterways, but then often they vote, you know, for bills that do the opposite. So we certainly work with every party and all politicians, but some are not very good on the environment and some are.
So, in addition to some of the spots we've already talked about, I imagine there being important spots on the river because that's where, you know, the coal ash is impacting the water. Or there's favorite spots on the river because you really like them. Can you think of a couple, you know, important slash favorite spots on the river?
Yeah, I mean, the obviously the power plant is a, you know, is a big, was a big looming, you know, potential catastrophe. So that was a really important spot from a, you know, a water quality, you know, a damaging perspective. I really love the stretch of the French Broad River, you know, as it flows, you know, from Marshall, you know, into Tennessee. It's extremely beautiful, flows through a gorge. It's in a lot of its natural forest. You got some whitewater. It's just a really nice trip. There was a bunch of river keepers in town recently, and they, you know, they wanted to go float the French Broad. And so I thought, you know, if you only had a couple of days to float the river, where would you go? And we took them, put in hot springs and took out down near Newport. And it's a really nice stretch of river. It's big cliffs. And so, yeah, it's a neat stretch of river.
So you talked to other river keepers.
Yeah.
What do you guys talk about?
We work together a lot. We actually have a meeting next week in Raleigh to work on the farm issue around the state. We have an annual conference every year. We're trying to work together more because we've realized, you know, if we work together as a team, we're a pretty powerful group of people, and we, you know, we have a large voice. We have a lot of people that care about the river. If we can, you know, magnify that voice and magnify our resources, it really helps. So we do work on a lot of sort of shared campaigns, and we are actively working to expand those shared campaigns so we can be more effective.
This is your full-time job. We're in an office in downtown Asheville. Where does money come for this? I'm assuming a couple different places.
Yeah, a lot of different places. We get foundation support, which is really important because they can write big checks. We get grants. We have members throughout the watershed, and we do, you know, fundraisers. We do a bunch of the Riverkeeper beer series we were talking about earlier as a fundraiser. So we get a dollar of every beer that's sold. You know, that's, you know, a small fundraiser, but it's great. It raises awareness and it raises a little bit of money. And then, you know, we'll get some bigger grant checks. And then membership is really important too. I mean, getting the community to buy into what you're doing. And, you know, if you can build up your membership numbers, you can definitely grow your budget. And we have grown our budget a lot. We've got, when I started at what used to be Western North Carolina Alliance, is now Mountain True, we had maybe 4 staff members. And now I think we have 14. So, and that's great. We do a lot more than we used to do, you know.
The Riverkeeper job predates Mountain True?
Yeah, so I used to work for another organization and the position moved to Mountain True because Mountain True was really just more of an effective advocate to really using all the tools in the toolbox to protect our waterways.
Is there state money at all for?
We really don't get any. I don't think we get any state or local money, and some of that's by design because a lot of the time, you know, the state might be the problem. And for, you know, the coal ash is a great example. I mean, the state refused to act, and you know, if we had a big giant check from the state, we, you know, might have been less likely to go out in public and tell the real story. So
if you watch documentaries, it seems like the story is somebody makes a lot of money. That money allows them great influence over the government with related to campaign donations, and that creates the problem. Is that pretty much the story here?
Well, yeah. I mean, it is with the coal ash. I mean, Duke Energy is a classic example. They're a multi-billion-dollar corporation. They didn't like the results of the science that came out, so they went and changed the law, you know, and they did it in pretty short order. They went and rounded up a bunch of folks. And there was even a story, someone that was down there lobbying told me that they were on the elevator with some legislators, and they said, they were talking about a group of people that had voted against the bill, and they said, well, they won't be getting any campaign contributions from Duke. I mean, yeah, often if you follow the money, that's, mm-hmm. and it's unfortunate that a company like Duke, that is a multi-billion-dollar company, won't step up to the plate and do the right thing. I mean, they paid for millions of dollars in marketing and advertisements with commercials saying, we're going to do the right thing. I'd love if they spent the money to actually do the right thing as opposed to pay for radio ads saying we're going to do the right thing.
Right. Did you grow up here?
I grew up in Georgia. I grew up going to summer camp here.
Hmm.
So that's kind of my connection to the French Broad River. Actually, as a summer camper, we used to do overnight trips on the French Broad River. In that stretch of river I was talking about from Hot Springs. So.
Yeah, when you were in high school, what did you think you'd be doing now?
You know, I loved...
Maybe you never thought about it.
I probably did. I loved, like, outdoor stuff. And so it's actually worked out really well. And I started off loving outdoor stuff, but having no idea how that could be a job. Just wanted to do things like paddle and camp and hike and bike and... But realized that all those places that I like to camp and bike and hike, if they weren't protected, I wasn't going to be able to do those things. So that was kind of really my foray into environmentalism. It's kind of a selfish notion that I wanted to paddle on clean rivers and I wanted to go hike in a nice area.
So here's it. It sounds like maybe we talked a little bit before we turned the camera on that you do some writing. It sounds like you didn't maybe expect to do much writing. This is sort of a different hat for me as I teach a required first year writing class. There are people who think they're never going to write. Can you tell me a little bit just about you and writing and how you get the work done?
Oh yeah. You can tell your students that like writing is important. I mean, you know, being able to communicate is extremely important and you're never going to get away. I mean, just crafting emails, is a lot of writing. And then, yeah, being able to get your message out there, writing is a really effective way to do that.
One thing I would say is writing is thinking, and when you become a better writer, you become a better thinker. And when you walk up to a state representative or someone from Duke, I mean, there's a certain thing you hope happens in this conversation, and that causes you to say, well, I need to say this first, and I'm going to try to go here, and I can't say that without telling them this. Those are the kind of things we think about. But it seems like, I feel like I've seen you in multiple publications. Does that feel like a horrible thing when you have to write 1,000 words for somebody? How do you go about doing that?
No, I think I enjoy it if there's time to do it. Like, I'd love to have more time to, like, we have a Riverkeeper beer series blog, but I just hadn't done as many as I would like to do. I find it enjoyable to write about fun stuff, you know, to be able to talk about the work we're doing, which I think is important, to be able to talk about trips we're doing. And I was a horrible writer for a long time. I'm still not great, but I realized it was important. Like, I basically, in school, I thought writing's not important. I don't want to be a writer, so writing's not important. And I also thought in Spanish class, I never need to know Spanish.
Right.
And now Spanish is really important and writing's really important. It's one of those things you realize your parents were right about everything.
So thanks for agreeing to talk to me. Is there anything in this office we ought to take a look at? I see a couple big checks over there on the wall. Is there anything you should...
I'm a fan of big checks.
Yeah.
We get giant checks and it seems important. We do some fundraisers every year. We've done a big one with Sweetwater every year and we do a big grand finale show. We had a couple posters. We had the Whalers. We had Steve Earle, Modest Yahoo. And so we'll do a giant check presentation on stage, which is cool. This office is filled with many interesting things. There's old signs. There's water quality monitoring equipment right behind you. We just got done with a paddle trip. We got a freezer full of water samples. So there's, but nothing particularly worth examining, maybe.
Yeah, well, thanks for talking to me today.
No problem. Thank you.